In 1995, while Will Smith was on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and Martin Lawrence was on Martin, the two teamed up for the cop buddy movie Bad Boys. They reunited in 2003 for Bad Boys 2, and now, almost 17 years later, they're back in Bad Boys for Life.
Bad Boys for Life comes to theaters in a very different atmosphere around policing than existed in 1995. And the cops in the film have changed too. There are still car chases and guns and bad guys, but there are also grandkids and deteriorating vision, and there's even Vanessa Hudgens. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about Bad Boys for Life on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me and Stephen in the studio is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And in our fourth chair, we're delighted to welcome back Soraya Nadia McDonald, the culture critic for The Undefeated. Hey, Soraya.
Hello again.
I must say, I would probably not have gone to this film if we had not decided to talk about it.
Right.
But I'm ultimately wound up being kind of glad I did. I miss fun Will Smith. What do you think, Glenn?
Well, one of the reasons we're talking about it is that this film got a cinema score of an A. Now, we talked about CinemaScore before. It's a company that polls opening night moviegoers, asks them to rate the film A to F. Bad Boys for Life got an A. It can be argued that since it's a poll of a very enthusiastic audience, the opening night audience, what it truly measures is how well a given film met that audience's expectations.
Exactly. The people who are excited to see it.
Exactly. So if it's a brand new film, what you're measuring is how well the marketing did to kind of set the table. With a franchise film, you're saying you're measuring how well that film folds into the franchise. Mm-hmm. And while it does, this film does make some attempts to course correct for some of the, not even malicious, but just reflexive, autonomic racism, sexism, homophobia of the first two films. That's not just endemic to it. It's like the buddy cop genre kind of trades on those. It is so much a throwback, a very deliberate throwback. And while it does engage with the notion that Smith and Lawrence are dinosaurs, they're still, as y'all mentioned, explosions and car chases and gunplay and police brutality as punchline, which Soraya has some very smart things to say about. Mostly, though, this is an exercise in the same throttled, tortured, fearful, heterosexually performative form of male friendship that I don't see movies about anymore because I just choose not to see movies about that anymore. Met every one of my expectations, though, so I understand that A.
Yeah. It's funny when you say throwback because one of the first things you see in this movie is this banner for Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer. Mm-hmm. And Don Simpson passed away in 1996.
Yep.
But he and Bruckheimer started this franchise. They, as producers, made this. They made Beverly Hills Cop, Flashdance, Top Gun, Crimson Tide. You cannot overestimate how important those guys were in a very specific time period in terms of certainly the buddy cop kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, the wisecracking cop kind of thing. But also, like, even Flashdance. Like, they were just very tuned into hit-making. Soraya, what's kind of your basic take on this? I want to get back to some of your finer points in a little bit. But what's your basic takeaway from Bad Boys for Life?
I don't find myself surprised by the cinema score at all because it does feel like a very, like, throwback Bad Boys movie. Really almost, like, sort of in line with the first one more than the second, which was just so big and crazy and off-putting. If you remember the cadavers, like, rolling out of this van while they were doing a car chase in the second movie, and they were having to either dodge them or just run over them. This one isn't quite so crazy in that sense. I found myself surprised at how much it was trying to engage with the idea of Mike Lowry and Marcus Burnett as two, like, aging guys, and also as with Mike, sort of this suspended adolescence that he's finally having to come to terms with and maybe start acting or thinking like a grown-up.
Well, and Marcus having that feeling of, like, maybe it's really time to be done with this nonsense, which the funny thing is the film has kind of no patience for and kind of assumes that that's not a legitimate way for him to feel.
Right.
And I'm like, I don't know. Stephen, what'd you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I think this movie is a mixed bag. At the same time, like, I do think it is a reminder of what audiences are looking for in a number of ways. I mean, this movie came out on January 17th, kind of at the same time as like Doolittle. And you just think, okay, this is a dumping ground for garbage. But you see how well it's done, not only in CinemaScore, but at the box office. And you get a reminder of a couple of things that audiences are looking for. Audiences are looking for fun. They're looking to be entertained. When we talked about the movie Knives Out as like an awards contender, and it's like, well, it's too fun to be an awards contender. So dropping this movie kind of right in the heart of awards season, I thought was a really clever bit of counter-programming, that a lot of what audiences are looking for is not necessarily the same grim historical dramas. They want to go to the movies and be entertained. And I also think when you look at the three movies that Will Smith has put out in the last like 9 months, his big like starring vehicles, you have Gemini Man, which was kind of this plotting thing that audiences clearly didn't want. You had Aladdin, which was Aladdin. And then you have this kind of goofy, knockabout, like big action-y, explosion-y movie. Speaking purely critically, I think this movie's a mixed bag. I think it's solidly 30 to 40 minutes too long. You know, I have a number of quibbles with it along the way. It's got a lot of the kind of, you're off the case, McBain, kind of stuff.
One last case.
You know, it's got it is so on rails in that way. But like, I get why this movie is resonating in a number of ways.
Yeah, I agree. And it's funny because it's not just that it's a throwback in terms of the production, which we were talking about, the producers, which we were talking about, and Will Smith and Martin Lawrence, who we were talking about. But it's so interesting to me that there is such a formula for these sort of, I feel like with cop movies, you have your New York and Chicago cop movies, which are always very kind of closed in, and the chases take place in little small areas. There's a lot of going back and forth between chases on foot and chases in cars. And then you have your kind of LA and Miami cop stuff where you're always looking at kind of longer stretches of roads, car chases that involve kind of open road.
Right.
And when I started to watch this, it opens with that sort of, I find really fun. I do enjoy a good car chase, especially one like this where I can actually follow what's going on. And it's not all about, a cut every half a second so that you lose track of time and space, which I've complained about an adequate number of times probably. And I did ultimately enjoy it, I think, although one of the things that Soraya mentioned in her piece that I just, the whole like the generic Mexican villainy.
Yeah.
That has kind of taken over from what was in my youth a generic Russian villainy, and then has also been at times a generic Middle Eastern villainy, has now become a generic Mexican villainy that shows up in a lot of movies, including this one.
You know, I feel like I said this to my editor last year, that I just wish I could see more movies like about Mexican people, Latinx communities at large, that don't have anything to do with the cartel. That is definitely sort of like the dominant image in a film industry where like depictions of Latinx people like writ large is very, very tiny.
Yeah.
And then you have this sort of overrepresentation of violence and drug trafficking and everything that comes along with it. In this particular instance, the scapegoat for all of, Mike's sort of worst impulses turns out to be a woman who is a witch.
Yeah.
Literally.
You could tell they kind of thought they were doing something interesting there by like, but it's a woman. Like I was,
right.
Okay. The thesis of your piece has to do with Will Smith. I mean, a big part of what you were writing about has to do with Will Smith and the way that he has built so much of his fame. Would you agree kind of this is the film that was at the root of his blockbuster movie stardom?
Yes. Like this in Independence Day,
this
right?
in Independence Day, and that he has played so many police officers. So talk to me a little bit about what that thesis was.
You know, the thing that I remember about Will Smith, and particularly in the 90s, is when he was on everyone's lips. And there was this moment, I think, when he was on Oprah. It might have been when he was promoting Hitch, now that I think about it.
Yeah.
And he had just sort of ascended to this place in pop culture where he was the biggest movie star in the world. There was nothing this man, like, couldn't open, including, like, Wild Wild West.
Right.
And Well, I started thinking about this actually when they announced that there was going to be a third Bad Boys movie, I think a few years ago, because he was having such a hard time kind of transitioning into middle age as an actor.
Yep. And also seriousness, I feel like. I feel like he's been, do you agree? I feel like he's been straining for the awardsy, and it's gone in the way of these kind of maudlin, the 7 pounds and the
collateral beauty. Really sort of like movies that aren't all that deep, but he's trying to force this depth onto them. And so, you know, when there's this announcement that there's going to be a third Bad Boys movie, you're like, oh, he's going back to the thing that has been successful for him, right? This is the thing that people love when he does. And so I started going back and I was like, geez, like Will Smith has actually played like a ton of cops just in different variations, you know, whether he's sort of playing, you know, one of the first Secret Service agents in Wild Wild West, or he's playing like a futuristic robot cop in iRobot, or he's playing, you know, a space fed in Men in Black. You know, I started thinking about the role that those roles played in making him a movie star, and in particular, making him this black man a movie star. And what is it about, like, Will Smith, like, in these particular roles that's so appealing that we keep coming back to them over and over again? And I was fortunate enough to have this really great conversation with Alyssa Rosenberg, who did, like, a multi-part series for The Washington Post about pop culture and policing. And basically, you know, she was saying that, like, police departments on screen act as a citizenship-making machine. So that, you know, if a person is, like, donning a badge, and I think to some extent this also works for soldiers.
Right.
You're entrusted with a badge and a gun, that you are sort of imbued with the sort of full faith and citizenship and trust that may not necessarily come from just being a black civilian, like, in the world, in America.
Right.
And the thing is that, like, you see this over and over again as sort of a means for pursuing stardom when it comes to black actors, right? Like, part of it is that the buddy cop genre in particular is just, like, really popular, but it also works as a way of saying, here is a black man on screen that you can root for, whether it's Sidney Poitier, whether it's Danny Glover, whether it's Eddie Murphy. Like, this is a formula that's been around for a really long time.
Yeah.
You know, and especially, like, when you start to think about sort of the longstanding anxieties that have existed when it comes to portraying black men on screen in romantic situations. This is the thing that says, basically, is sort of giving an audience permission to sort of, like, fully engage with and be on the side of this protagonist.
Right. Glenn, how do you respond to these two performances, one of which is, I feel like, and I don't know if you agree, I feel like, as Soraya is saying, Will Smith is playing this kind of, like, tuned-in cop. And I feel like the Martin Lawrence performance is broader, certainly, and it's a little goofier. And in some ways, it feels like they're in the same movie, and in some ways, they seem sometimes like they're in very different movies, especially when Will Smith gets very emotey.
Yeah. I mean, I think Smith is just the better actor. He's more charismatic. Lawrence is solid here, but he is a comedian who is acting. You can hear him reading his lines in a way that you can't with Smith, because there's just something effortless about his on-screen persona and something effortless about his life, frankly, where there's more of a striving character in Lawrence's life and character. I was waiting for the quips. I was waiting for this vaunted chemistry to return. And on the level of jokes is where the film disappointed me the most, I think, because there's an exchange where two characters are talking about the Will Smith character, and Will Smith character says, "Hey, I'm standing right here," which is a 2003 NBC sitcom joke. It is not a 2020 major film that is expecting you to trade on this incredible chemistry. And I do think the script underperformed for them. I think they did what they could with the material, but I just didn't think I wasn't convinced by this relationship. Couches it in this kind of whole macho BS.
They want to establish that these guys are older. This is the first Bad Boys movie in almost 17 years. They want to establish that they have matured, that their stories have changed. And I appreciated that, you know, and at the same time, it's not Logan. You know, yeah. This is
exactly
this movie is not digging really all that deep. It's kind of paying lip service to a real deepening and richening of the story. I agree with you, Glenn. I wish the banter, the repartee had popped a little bit more, because then I think among other things, the movie wouldn't have dragged as much as it did for me. I wouldn't be coming out of it saying that needed to be a half hour shorter if the script had been sharper.
Sure. All right. Well, let us know what you think about Bad Boys for Life. I know a lot of you have seen it. I know a lot of you are going. I can tell from the box office number. So tell us what you thought. Find us at Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment, What's Making Us Happy This Week. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Behind the Scenes, The Witcher, the official companion podcast for the Netflix series, The Witcher. So how did the writers, cast, and crew take almost 3,000 pages of original material and bring this world to light? In Behind the Scenes of The Witcher, host Brandon Jenkins finds out what it takes to adapt a fantasy book series into a season of television. New episodes premiere mid-January, with new episodes weekly. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What's making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Influencers in the Wild is an Instagram account. It is part behind the scenes expose and part a cultural feedback loop. It features candid videos, okay, of various people in beautiful settings taking Instagram pictures and videos of themselves.
Oh, I like it.
Or their friends. But the videos that are posted to this are taken by people who happen to also be in that place going, what the hell's going on over there? So you watch the pains that people are taking to make themselves look effortless and attractive and beautiful and alone on a windswept beach when we pull back and see it. It's just crowded, but they've aimed the camera at exactly the part that they can see me alone, or doing warrior pose at sunset on some veranda. It's a look behind the artifice, the fatuousness, the effort behind every selfie you see on social media. It's influencers in the wild, all run together, one word.
Nice.
All right. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, I am a parent of teenagers, and one of the things that you lose when you make the transition from being a parent of young children to a parent of teenagers is you don't get to read to your kids the way you used to, unless you have very patient teenagers, which I do not. And I felt that transition acutely when I was at a bookstore recently and picked up a copy of a children's book, a brand new children's book called The Serious Goose by Jimmy Kimmel, written and drawn by Jimmy Kimmel, clearly as a love letter to his own young children. And I read the whole thing in the bookstore. It took about 45 seconds. and I just, the entire...
Did you have to ask anybody to help you with any words?
I got a little assistance. Man, reading this thing, I just thought the entire time how much of a meal I would have made of that book.
Oh, yeah.
If I were reading it to my kids, just because the whole premise is like this, just this scowling serious goose, and like your job as the reader is kind of cracking up the goose, and it's just, you just can imagine reading this book with just silly voices making your kids giggle. It demands like a fully committed reading. But man, if you are a parent, if you are like a doofy parent who like really covets the opportunity to get silly with your kids at reading time. Like, I used to read Lily's Big Day to my daughter almost entirely in monster voices. This is just ideal for that. Ah, man, I still may try reading it to my daughter. She's 15.
I'm sure you could find a willing baby.
I bet I can make it happen. But it is delightful. It's enormously charming. It's called The Serious Goose by Jimmy Kimmel.
All right. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Soraya McDonald, what is making you happy this week?
What's making me happy this week is actually a personal project. I am really proud to have an essay in a new collection called Believe Me, How Trusting Women Can Change the World, edited by Jessica Valenti and Jacqueline Friedman, which came out this week. And so I'm really just excited that people are finally going to get to read all the wonderful essays in this book and that I'll be able to talk about them with people.
And the title of it again is?
Believe Me, How Trusting Women Can Change the World.
Thank you very much. What a good pick. It's always good when you can say something I did. I love it myself. Before I talk about my happy, I do want to tell you, we are gearing up for the Oscars, of course. You know it's that time of year for us. We'll have a big Oscars preview coming next week. Leading up to that, if you're a Spotify user and you're trying to catch up on all the Best Picture nominees, they have all been, all of our Best Picture nominee episodes have been rolled into a Spotify playlist. You can find that by searching for Oscars 2020 from Pop Culture Happy Hour on Spotify. And you can just binge listen to all of them and remember what we thought about all of those, because we have at this point covered them all. So you can find that on Spotify. We will also link to it in our newsletter. If you're not subscribed to the newsletter, as always, it's npr.org/popculturenewsletter. And so that is a special resource we have heading into the Oscars. So what is making me happy this week? As we have spoken about on this show before, if you are a basic cable channel and you have something that is successful, Netflix is coming to try to eat your lunch. And the most recent addition is everybody is trying to eat the lunch of Project Runway, including Amazon, which is making the Heidi Klum, Tim Gunn show. But Netflix is also coming, and theirs is called Next in Fashion. The hosts are Alexa Chung and Tan France of Queer Eye. They did a competition that there, it's sort of Project Runway like in many ways, but everybody operates in pairs. And the I don't typically love team challenges on Project Runway. You get a lot of people fighting and all that stuff. But these are different. These are, in many cases, people who work together already. And so you have more than one hand. And this show is not generally about, can you complete a look that does not look stupid? Can you get it sewn together so that the model doesn't have her behind hanging out when they go down the runway or whatever, or, you know, terrible seams or whatever. This is more an actual design show. I found this to be more about actual principles of design, talking about why did you design it this way? What are you trying to convey? This kind of show is everybody's got their own preferences, and competitive reality is one of those things where you just like what you like. But in this case, I kind of liked this one because it doesn't come down to, you can tell in the final challenge when they're making the kind of collection, they get a team of sewers, essentially a team of assistants. And you can tell just from that, it's not meant to be, can you physically execute clothes all by yourself? Right. It's actually meant to be about design. So again, that's Next in Fashion. And by the time you hear this, it is available on Netflix. And that's what's making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes, Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, and Glenn at G.H. Weldon. You can find Soraya at Soraya McDonald. You can find our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music that you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second and you're so inclined, please subscribe to our newsletter. That's at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all right back here next week.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of How I Built This from NPR. How do you turn an okay idea into a better one? Check out the How I Built This podcast and my live conversation with Stuart Butterfield, founder of Slack and Flickr, as he explains the art of the pivot. Listen now.